Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Welcome back to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, a global movement that seeks to put them, the children, before us, the adults, when it comes to matters of marriage and family. As always, I am joined by my executive director, Josh Wood, and we're going to talk through some of the items that are kind of hitting your newsfeed these days or your radio waves, or maybe just the conversations that you are having, because we are in that holiday season where we are gathering with family and friends, which is delightful and wonderful. And honestly, we need a little more face-to-face with the people that we love. So give me all the Thanksgiving all the time. We usually start out with some Bible time, and we are going to talk about giving thanks with a grateful heart and why it is that we have a national holiday around Thanksgiving. And I'm going to let Josh sort of summarize a bit of, let's talk about the Thanksgiving story that I grew up on, that I heard about when I was in school, that we celebrated even as a non-Christian, kind of secular Pacific Northwesterners, New Age spirituality, all roads lead to God. Even I knew this story growing up. And then I want to ask you about how things have changed. So Josh, first of all, give us the Thanksgiving story.
Okay. And this is a disclaimer, I'm not a historian. So this is just what I would say, the traditional story, that the pilgrims were English believers who wanted to worship God without interference, and they crossed the Atlantic. We all know about the Mayflower. They settled at Plymouth. Their first winter was difficult. They got through with a little help from the local tribe. Indigenous Americans, Native Americans, and when they harvested their crops, they said, we need to have a day of thanks, kind of a feast. And that spirit of gratitude kind of caught on. But what's I think is super interesting is during the Civil War, this is like 1863 is when it became a national holiday. It's like a national day of Thanksgiving, and it recognizes explicitly the blessings of Almighty God. And then you see later, 1863 to 1941, it actually becomes a national observance with a set day. And what, Katie, what's kind of interesting about both of those, 1941 and 1863, we are both on the cusp of or in the middle of major conflicts for our country. So I don't know. I don't know totally the significance of that, but that's interesting to me that it's not like this was the roaring 20s, and we were giving thanks, or in the middle of the gold rush, and we're giving thanks to God. This is both during very difficult times in our country's history.
That's a great observation. And gratitude really is sort of the antithesis of depression, of isolation, of despair, that it really is a dispositional step that everybody can take, regardless of the circumstances they find themselves in. And obviously, it's pretty incredible to celebrate that collective Thanksgiving that is like pre-constitution. Like, we just set foot on these shores and endure hardship and then come together giving thanks for God's blessing, getting through a really difficult season. You know, I grew up really understanding that, believing it. Like, I remember when I was, you know, I'm a child of the 80s. Like, that's when I was kind of in my elementary school years. And we would, like, make the construction paper, like Puritan hats, and we would do pageants, and there would be kids that are dressed up as the pilgrims, and there were the kids dressed up as the Indians, and, like, it was all culturally very inappropriate according to kind of where we are today. And I was actually spending a little time before we got on and started talking. Like, my kids went to public elementary school. Some of them did a little bit of private school and they got some of the Thanksgiving story. But the ones that were in public elementary school, they really didn't talk much about this. Nobody came home with a cute little like pilgrim merch that they had put together in their third grade class. And really what we've seen more is there was too much of a mythology around the Pilgrim's arrival. And actually, we need to highlight the indigenous suffering of the people that were there prior to. And so we've had sort of a decolonize of the Thanksgiving tradition. And it makes me sad because I actually think that that's a very sweet and like neutral, like nobody's pushing anything here. We're just talking about two different groups of people who came together and helped one another. And I would say primarily the help would be from, you know, the native tribes towards the new settlers. And it was a time before you had any of these debates about, you know, ethnic cleansing that was happening on behalf of the whites and, we took their land and we pushed them on reservations. And actually, I think all of those are really important conversations to have. But why can't we just have this one sweet memorial? Why can't we just have this beautiful tribute to these two people that didn't even speak the same language, who wanted each other to survive, and that they got along and they celebrated a meal together? I just think it's actually a real tragedy that we're not sharing that same story with kids anymore.
Well, Katie, I saw something from an interview that Jonathan Haidt did with the Free Press. He wrote The Anxious Generation. I think Righteous Mind was a book before that he wrote about virtue. Point being, he talks about how when they looked at all the data of all the kids that and the things they consumed, that it tended towards progressive teenagers and the feeds they constantly followed, that A, they consumed more media, and B, were the most prone to depression. And he kind of correlated that with the types of media they're consuming tend to be centered around how difficult your life is, how victimized you are, how even the good people you thought you knew actually are, you know, take your pick. They're flawed. They supported slavery. You go down the list. And it's not always like that, but it's constantly pointing out the things that are wrong, the injustice, how everything in life is just good versus evil, and what are you going to be on? Instead of it being gray, things being complicated, and us taking a moment to just say, man, I mean, there's no perfect person. And we can say that this country has made mistakes for sure. If we get to a point where we can't just stop and say thanks, and man, we were born into a pretty advantaged country and we've got a lot of advantages as a result of being here. And man, I'm just glad it wasn't somewhere else. And we're allowed to say that. Again, I'm like, as a parent now thinking about this with my children, I think having a time, one day a year where we go, you guys have so much. Life may have its difficulties, some that we can't protect you from, but all in all, it is a winning the lottery being born into this country with the freedoms we have, and we need to be grateful. And by the way, we need to be grateful to God who made this all possible.
I saw some clips from that Jonathan Haidt interview, and you know, he's not a religious Christian. You know, he is just a sociologist that is studying different societal trends as it relates to what's happening with the next generation. And he's been extremely alarmed. But here's just a quote from what he said. He said, "It's the liberal girls who really rise first and fastest on depression. Everyone is worse off. But being a conservative seems to root you. You're not as easily pushed into the crazy world." And then he said, "Even better if the conservative kids are religious." And so, you know, we look at sort of the polarizing nature of the cultural debate and we're like, well, you know, liberal, progressive, it's, you know, same, you know, it's just one side of the other coin. You can be on the right, you can be on the left, everyone finds their preferences. But the reality is one of these worldviews is anchored in something beyond the immediate. And the conservative worldview does have an anchor in history, true history. And there's something valuable about recognizing the truth of history. That's not to say that you sanitize it and pretend like there wasn't any problems when the pilgrims and the white settlers came to the Americas. I'm not saying that great injustices were not done. But the idea that our country is good, this nation is amazing, freedom of worship is incredible, and we can anchor ourselves to this history with pride and with patriotism. And that it's okay to say, it's good to say, I love this country, because its traditions and its heritage overall was a boon, not just for the people living here, but for people across the world, that America overall has been a force for good across the globe. And conservative kids are more likely to hear that message. It's the liberal kids who are hearing that we need to decolonize the Thanksgiving story. And those pilgrims, like, that's mythologized. They weren't really that great. They're not that pure. They didn't work that hard. They're oppressors. I mean, that same kind of worldview and mindset that liberal girls especially seem to be drinking like from a fire hose from their social media is having a very real impact on their mental health versus the kids that are more anchored in, does it have some like shiny veneer to it, that story of the pilgrims? Yeah, it probably does. But it's also anchored in time, space, history. And there's something about that that stabilizes kids and leads them to the place where they're a little more resistant to some of, you know, the crazy ways, as Jonathan Haidt would put it.
Well, I love the words that he used in that interview, talking about how it seems like a conservative worldview, a Christian worldview, is a defense against some of these things. It defends you from falling off that cliff. And I would say, when you start talking about how we remember our history and how we, again, we have icons of the past, and that can be very helpful to children to have heroes. There's oftentimes, though, like a backlash in admitting fault at all with some of these heroes, because there's a fear, I think, on the conservative or the Christian side, where they say, you know, if I admit any fault of this individual, now suddenly I'm almost giving him over or her over to be completely condemned and no longer an icon. And I would just say, it's okay for things to be gray. It's okay. I mean, again, I would even say, as Christians, Katie, we're equipped to say, well, of all of our heroes biblically, David, I mean, you can go down the list, like Moses, they made significant mistakes. Noah, we know that. We think that, but for the grace of God, that would have been their entire story. Mm-hmm. And so I think having confidence in, as we recollect and go through these, I think we can teach the whole truth and say, man, we've done so much good. And man, they made some mistakes, and maybe it's, you know, we can't discount how long ago that was, and maybe they didn't have access to all the same information, and or maybe they just made poor choices. But here's some of the good things they did, and man, we can be grateful for those. I think holding those things in tension, and don't make it easy for kids to say that's the enemy and that's the hero. To say we're all flawed, but for the grace of God, that would be any one of us. And man, I pray that they treat us, you know, with more grace than we're treating those that were 100 years ago. Because you don't think in 150 years they're not going to be looking back at some of the decisions we make and saying, "Oh, that poor person supported XYZ policy. Tear it down. They're horrible." You know, we have to expect they're going to do that to us too.
C.S. Lewis calls that chronological snobbery, where you look back on anything that came before you and you go, "Oh, those people weren't sophisticated. Look at them. They thought that. They believed that. We're so much better because we believe in this thing that has been around for literally 5 minutes of history. We are so much more superior than they are." When the reality is that, I think he said, for every new book you read, you should read two old books, because it grounds you. And if there is a danger to idolizing, there is a danger to sanitizing, but the way to do that is more exposure to history, not less. That's what you need to do, is more exposure to a variety of different people with lots of different ideas. Biographies, not that I'm like the queen of biographies, but the times when I've read them with my kids, I mean, it really will, it shapes your worldview in a way that leads you to more realism, right? And less ideology, less kind of idolizing things that shouldn't be idolized. It draws out the timeless principles in ways that simply living in your own cultural moment is going to afford you. And especially for kids, it's going to give you the kind of appreciation for the people that have gone before. It is going to chart your course. Like Jonathan Haidt said, it roots you. You put your roots down so that you can grow into a person, a tree, that's going to provide fruit and shade and protection, not just for yourself, but for the family that you're going to form, so that you too are going to continue the tradition of having people at your house for Thanksgiving.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
We're back with Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, here with my executive director of Them Before Us, Josh Wood, talking through a few of the items that have caught our eye when it comes to trending news. And the first thing we're going to talk about is this story that emerged from the UK. The BBC was reporting the rapid rise of surrogacy in the United Kingdom. And it talked about several different women who had carried multiple babies for other couples, often using their own eggs. Okay, so one of the reasons why we can sort of dismiss surrogacy as, you're the oven for somebody else's bun. No, this is somebody that is the biological mother of the child and the genetic mother of her child, renting out her womb and selling her own child to people who want it. The story is called, I've Had 7 Babies for Other Families. So really, it's highlighting this practice of we're actually creating an industry of women that serve as sort of perpetual handmaids for wealthier couples. Josh, do you want to tell us a little more about this story and what you think it's pointing to?
Well, this it comes out of the BBC, and it is talking about how this has been, and Katie, we all know this, when you open that door to surrogacy, there's often a lot more demand than there is people willing to do it for free. And what does that cause? I mean, it causes insane payments, cost. I mean, and we've listened to a couple interviews as a staff on this. One was circulating just the other day that was talking about all of the expenses one of their surrogates got, plus the stipend for lost wage. I mean, you really get down to it, Katie, and you realize as you dig in, there is essentially a compensation package offered to these women. And it gets particularly crazy, although it's a distinction, to be honest, without a difference, when people carry their own eggs and then get pregnant and have the child. And so essentially, this whole article just talks about, do we need to update this to update the surrogacy laws, not to make more narrow the pathway, but to broaden it, to make it more available, because demand is increasing. And you do get across the spectrum. You've got the same sex couple who this is their only pathway. If you are two males, the only pathway you've got here is to use an egg donor to get a surrogate. If you're going to create a child, that's your path. Well, there's also the very rich couple that may not be in a season of life where I was watching a commercial for it the other day, and they said, we just weren't in a season of life to take all that time off of work. So we just had someone, you know, essentially be cooking the baby while we're working. We have high powered jobs, all these different things. And so, man, where is this headed? It occurs to me, Katie, that they have made it such a branding issue. At its core, this industry is allowing women, whether it is one step removed, an egg donor giving an egg to a surrogate who then gives the baby, and so we feel some separation from the mother, or it is a mother using her own egg and then giving the baby directly. To frame this as altruistic, to frame this as doing a good deed for a neighbor, is such a twisted distortion of language that it is only possible because the victim in this situation is in the womb. If this was a 15-year-old, 20-year-old going, wait a second, you're doing what to me? This would never stand, but they can't organize politically. And then as they grow older, there's so many reasons. We talk to those kids all the time. They don't want to offend their parents. This is the only people that they knew. They've not met their biological mother. They're afraid of the consequences personally. They're so complicated as to why they can't speak out, although, as we know, a lot of them still do.
It's so fascinating to me that they chose to highlight this story over in the UK because it is a hot topic there right now. Obviously, like you said, demand for surrogacy far outpaces supply. And one of the ways that they want to try to change that is to be able to pay surrogates. So like you said, they already are getting all different kinds of compensation, not in the form of official payment. But honestly, nobody's going to do this 7 times if they are not benefiting financially in a way that they significantly need, that they feel meets a need for them. I was just on a call before this talking about how you need women in the reproductive process in two primary ways. you need their eggs and you need their womb. Both of those are very, very expensive to acquire. But it's very interesting because they don't advertise just anywhere when they're trying to get women to sell their eggs. They go to colleges, specifically they go to Ivy League universities, right? The number of advertisements in the student newspaper at Harvard or Yale or Columbia for women to quote unquote donate their eggs. It's off the charts because they want those young, healthy women with those fresh eggs who are also smart enough to get into these Ivy League schools. They want them for their genetic stock. They're not looking for surrogates at Yale. They're advertising for surrogates here in this country on military bases. That's what they want. They want working women, right? They want that healthy stock. They don't care what she looks like. And they don't care how smart she is. They just need a woman who is economically a little needier, who's already had some children of her own, that probably has great government-funded health care, whose husband might be away and she needs to find a way to bring in extra income without being away from her other three children. And so we do have a profile of women that tend to serve as surrogates. And it's not the uppity, it's not the well-to-do, it's not the bourgeois, it's not the celebrities, it's not the people that are 50 and they already can't take time away from their career because they've, you know, they're already opening like new franchises for the businesses that they're running. It is the women who are economically vulnerable. A lot of times these are going to be single mothers who are trying to make ends meet. They already have a job or two, and this is going to be their third job. So this idea that like, oh, this is just a woman helping other, no, it's not. Like nobody would do this. Women would not do this unless they were paid. This is an industry. And I will say, I had to laugh when I saw this coming out of the UK, because not a couple months ago, we were seeing reports that pensioners, so that's retirees in the UK, that there's an increased demand for parental orders for retirees who are making surrogate children. So now we've got these people who are retired, who are in their 60s, 70s, maybe in their 80s, who are commissioning some of these economically vulnerable women to create children who probably are not related to those 70-year-olds who are going to raise that newborn, honestly, just to be their live-in caregiver. So you cannot allow the surrogacy industry or big fertility to lie to you and say, this is just one woman helping her infertile sister have a baby after cancer treatments. That happens occasionally. That's not generally what surrogacy is all about.
Man. And it strikes me, Katie, if this is such an altruistic endeavor, and it really is just donation, and there is no commodification going on, why do they care how smart, in quotes, the eggs are? Because it's resale value. I mean, if we're really being honest, they pay well on Ivy Leagues because they can sell well to these couples. And again, it is being sold. And we make sense of it in our minds because it's only half of the equation. It's not a baby yet. And that's true. But we don't allow for that with kidneys, with livers. We've said this will lead to commodification and exploitation of people if we allow this marketplace to exist. With surrogacy, I'm telling you, the branding, the way they push so hard in shows, in media. When was the last time you saw a surrogate pregnancy in a movie where it was, hey, we went to Harvard and we bought this great woman's eggs. And yeah, we just got the sperm, you know, he went to the bathroom at the clinic and took care, like, and we paid this lady. She's our, you know, whatever, name the low collar, blue collar job. And she's not allowed to drink alcohol. And oh yeah, if she had a margarita, we would abort that baby. She's got to work out three times a day or else she doesn't get paid. Oh, we're letting her use the car. But if she, you know, you go down that list, they never portray it that way. It's always, oh, it's our neighbor. It's our sister. She's doing it totally for free. And it was such a, you know, it's such a washing to help people be okay with it. I mean, I don't even think we've all totally processed how well they have brainwashed the popular culture.
Yeah, it is. It's a PSYOP, baby. That's what I have to say. Big fertility is one big PSYOP. And it's the kids who are the losers, right? They depict this as just life-giving and generous and altruistic. But the reality is this is on-demand designer babies shipped worldwide under the name of Progress. And if you have got questions about this, if this is the first time you've tuned into Them Before Us, if this is the first time you've thought about surrogacy, come and learn at thembeforeus.com. We are probably one of the most front-facing organizations fighting against surrogacy because it has so much overlap with the world of child trafficking. And it's something that anybody, especially people that consider themselves to be Christians, need to be experts on. We've got all kinds of resources for you. We've got curriculum for your church. If you go to thembeforeus.com, you can do resources for churches. If you're running a company, we've got resources for you to structure your HR in a way where you're protecting kids from a lot of these technological innovations. We've got fact sheets. Like, you need to become an expert on this because you're probably horrified by some of what we've been talking about. And that is the right response. So take that frustration and anger and turn it into child protection.
Katie, Corinne and I, my wife, we were watching a movie the other day, and it was one of those kind of new movies that was talking about a guy that had a relationship with an AI bot or personality or companion, I guess they call it. And I'll tell you, our next story comes from International Institute of Family Studies, and they talk about the spread of this, and Senator Josh Hawley is working on an act that would protect children, but I was so curious about this because in the movie, my wife and I sat there going, this is insane. Like, this guy goes home, turns on his phone, falls asleep talking to this lady. It's wild. There's an update in the movie and he loses his girlfriend. I mean, it's just, and we were like, this is insanity. Well, then I pull up my phone. We were preparing for this radio show today, and 3 in 4 teens have used an AI companion. 3 in 4. And 1 in 5 high schoolers have had a romantic relationship with an AI character or know someone who has. 1 in 5. Mm-hmm. And you got to think.
I know somebody who has. Okay, that puts me a little bit at ease. I'm like, it can't be 1 in 5. But who knows somebody who have, that makes sense.
This is insanity. And again, this GUARD Act is trying to look at the links between digital addiction, our just mental health outcomes that are just falling off a cliff. And how China, who is in the midst of so much of this, is essentially going to try to hook our kids into so much of this to get them dependent on these things. Because, I mean, when you're drugged up with dopamine and you're involved in these relationships, you're depressed, you're not productive, you're not leading a great life, and that is a national security threat. And it just strikes me, man. We see how inefficient our Congress can be, how our government can be. And this is the front lines of technology, and they've got to try to find a way to regulate this to protect kids. I can't say I have like a ton of hope, Katie, that we're going to get that right.
We need some policy solutions, but it's all really parenting solutions. That's honestly where we're going to get this right, is it has to be in the home. I mean, it's got to be your house. The White House can only do so much. It has to be your house. So where do you begin? You got to know your kids. You have to know your kids. That's hard in any era, especially when you've got teenagers. By nature, they are developing their independence. And so it is harder to stay connected to your teenagers. But it is critical that you know what's going on in their world. What are they looking at online? Who are they spending time with? What influencers are they following, right? What is happening in their space of their brain? Like, what are they listening to? What are they listening to and looking at? You need to be the person that knows that better than anybody else. And you need to do that not by tracking their GPS location, not by jumping on their phone to check and see what they're doing. You need to develop the kind of relationship with your kids so that they tell you. So that there really isn't anything between you. I know some of you are going like, how do I do that? I would say it starts young. You lay the foundation when they're in elementary school. You ramp it up in middle school. And then in high school, your job is to double down on emotional connection and relational intimacy with them. That means a lot of physical proximity, doing things with them whenever possible, not with the screen, right? Sitting at the table together, talking in the car, doing sports, going on runs, doing activities that they like, getting involved in the things that they're interested in, opening the channels of communication so that if something bothers them, if they've heard something online, if they've got a big question they're wrestling with, you're there. You're there. And you've proven yourself to want to know them without freaking out. I will quickly plug Raising Conservative Kids in a Woke City. That is the second book that I co-authored with Stacey Manning. It is your tip on how to instill a biblical worldview into your children and navigate all of these different challenges. Because Josh, when I hear you talking about this, I'm horrified. The danger is so great. Because we've seen these AI companions maybe not just replace a romantic relationship. We've seen these AI companions coach kids on how to kill themselves. I mean, like it's actually very, very dire.
Well, you hit it nail on the head, though. As Christians, we do not look to big government to tell us how to parent our children. And for sure, there's some guardrails. And they should put up guardrails. And that's their job to put up guardrails. But the government is not responsible for our children. Which just goes to show you, Katie, how important it is for every kid to have two guardians. And I mean that as fathers and mothers. I don't mean just that any two people will do, but two people invested in them, protecting them, guiding them. We can't possibly grow the government big enough to play that role. And so we have to, again, this is where having a child's attachment to their mother and father makes all the difference, because this has to happen with every single kid in our country.
Yeah. We do love Senator Hawley, though, and we love his effort to look into this, because there are some things that parents can do that government can't do, but there are some things that government can do that we can't. And tangling with China and getting them to get their darn hands off our kids and out of their faces and off their screens isn't something I can do. So hats off to all of the people in Washington and at the state level who are doing that kind of defense that parents rely on. Stay with us. We'll be right back with some of your questions.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
Joined for this final section, segment of the radio show by Jen Friesen, our training director here at Them Before Us. And we did some like hot takes on Thanksgiving. We hit some hot topics in terms of what's trending these days. But now we want your hot questions. So Jen, what is it that we are going to be addressing today as it relates to kind of what's happening in the real world space?
Hi, Katie. You know, what I was thinking about was we have gotten flagged, or maybe let's say highlighted in a positive way, a few times recently from what we would call hate groups, but what they call themselves is watch groups. They put themselves as like, we're the bigotry and hate police. We're going to go after different organizations that we say are hateful and intolerant. And then ironically, we're going to be hateful and intolerant to them. And so I just wanted to get some thoughts from you. You know, what do we do when we get insulted, highlighted by some of these people? And I'll tell you a really quick story. This was on one of our social media posts. There was a man who identified as gay in the comments, and he was critiquing me personally and Kim Davis, who's the clerk who, you know, fought about, didn't want to have to sign gay marriage certificates. She went up to the Supreme Court, or they declined to take the case, I think recently. We've commented on it. And this guy was like, obviously, Kim Davis and you don't even know any gay men because they wouldn't let you go out looking like that kind of thing. I mean, just insulting. Okay. But then I was like, what is so funny is just using their language against them. I was like, oh, wow. A misogynist commenting on how women look on the internet. Like, shocker. And it's just funny because he actually thinks like, well, I get a pass. I'm a gay man. We've had the TV shows and gay men stereotypically, we know how to dress and all these things. And I was like, it's literally just your misogyny and you're being a toxic man hating women on the internet. Like, you're not even original, bro. So I can't even do anything other than laugh about it, which maybe gets to the point of how we deal with these people. But what is your answer, Katie, when you get highlighted by Right Wing Watch calling you an anti-LGBT bigot? because you were talking about the marriage campaign, and how should people react when we get highlighted by these folks?
Yeah, that was a clip from Washington Watch, which is the Family Research Council's evening broadcast. And we were talking about the Kim Davis case. And I was talking about, actually, it was a really fantastic clip. Like everything I said, I was like listening to it again. It's like 1 minute of this, you know, 7 minute interview. I'm like, oh, that's good. Oh, that was good. Oh, I worded that really well. Oh, that was nice. And they even let me plug our website at the end. They even like, I'm like, you're driving people to my platform. Thank you so much. I didn't even have to get in and be like, and if you want more information about our campaign to target gay marriage because it inflicts, you know, injustice upon children, go to endobergefell.com. I'm like, I didn't even have to. They like kept it in the clip. And so it's so funny because it was a really good like little snippet that they chose to include. And you know, in the past, sometimes they would do this to me before we had a really great organization with a lot of scaffolding and we had fewer media contacts. But now it's like, I retweet that with just something simple like, gosh, if I knew Right Wing Watch was watching, I would have had a better hair day. And then it just goes crazy, right? And what I love about it is then all of the people that like us and like our content, they repost it and they're like, hey, that's good stuff. Oh, you should watch this. And people are so funny. Like there was this one guy underneath, he's like, Right Wing Watch? More like, Right Wing Must Watch. This is must watch TV. Anyway, so I just put a comment underneath that, you know, where it said, Katie Faust, anti-LGBTQ activist. And I'm like, you mean Katie Faust, pro-child activist. And like, it's gotten, they've already been ratioed just with one comment. So I just feel like it's more of an indication that the vibe shift is real. People feel like, I don't have to put up with this anymore. You know, if you're targeting her, you would be targeting me. I think kids need moms and dads too. I don't think that it's bigoted or hateful to say that marriage should only be between a man and a woman for life. Like, if you're going to hate her, you would hate me. So come and get it, bro. So I don't know. It was amusing to watch all of that play out yesterday.
Yeah, I think the posture at this point has to be humor. Keeping it light, not taking it really seriously. Thankfully, you know, in this scenario, like you said, they're just doing my job for me. They're putting together a perfect clip. They're not posting your address. You know, there's not danger involved. They're doing name calling and posting a clip. It's kind of the usual thing. So we don't have to be afraid. And it's totally different what you see on the different kinds of social media as well. Like on their Facebook, it's fully in agreement with them. They don't have anyone who kind of puts in different perspectives. And on Twitter, it was almost fully for you, even under their posts, comments. It was all people who are like, that sounds pretty rational to me, kind of things. But I think too, it's like you said, this is a pretty rational argument. We're not arguing God hates you. That's why it's wrong. It makes me feel icky. That's why it's wrong. We're arguing that it's the rights of the child. They have one man, one woman that created them. They have a right to them. And that really is not bigoted when people actually take a second and listen. And now who knows how many people heard that had never heard of you before. That's pretty exciting. Okay, next question. Thinking about, we're coming into the holiday season. Thanksgiving is either, it's coming up, or depending on when people listen, maybe you've already had Thanksgiving, you've got Christmas coming up. What should you do if someone, one of your family members or friends, is at your dinner table and they are trying to start a fight about politics? You know they're trying to throw a grenade in there. They lead off with like, President Trump is the worst president we've ever had, or whatever it is. How do you navigate the difficult political conversations at the family holiday table?
So I bet everybody in the audience is like, oh, I get that. Oh, I've been there. Oh, I'm worried about that. Oh, I know that's going to happen. I think most of us probably have, I would actually say hopefully have, several people in our orbit that don't agree with us. That means that you're doing a good job of doing what you can to maintain the relationship, even though you're refusing to compromise. So I actually think that having those situations where you have the potential for a difficult conversation is an indication that you're being biblical, because God wants us to stand firm on the truth, but he doesn't want us to close our heart off to people that disagree with us. And you should not only be attending their family gatherings or their dinner invites, you should be inviting them to your house. So then what do you do when there is a fight that arises? A few things. Number one, as a Christian, I don't think that we should be aggressors. I don't think that we start the fight. I don't think that we instigate. But as Christians, we need to be ready to give an answer for the hope that is in us and all of the implications of the truth that go along with the hope that's in us. And so I think that if you are anticipating some kind of a battle, you want to be prepared, right? If you know that somebody is coming, they have an axe to grind about one specific issue, it doesn't hurt to brush up and know more than a little something about whatever it is that they're frustrated about, whether that's like the climate change question, or whether that is the ICE raids that they are seeing all over their news feed, or whether it is the gay marriage question that is popping up here and there. Know something about it. Then figure out where are the areas where you can find commonality. Where are the areas where you can say, that's a great point. I agree with you. I don't want people to have to live in fear. I do want to care for the planet. I understand that gay people are our friends and family and they have dignity. Wherever you can, find agreement. And then I would say, a lot of people are going to be watching. This is not primarily about, are you going to win this argument? You want to win everybody around you. And how do you win? It is by, at the end of the conversation, however it resolves, everybody goes, she was more beautiful than he was in that conversation. She managed herself better. She didn't personally attack. She tried to build bridges. That guy, that woman didn't let her. I trust her more than I trust him. That's what winning looks like. Jen, you are no stranger to combative conversations. How would you answer this question?
I think we've talked about this before, right? I think asking questions is always a great idea. Where did you hear that from or read that? I haven't read that before. And maybe they can pull it up and you can kind of get a context for what they're talking about. I was thinking as you were talking too, have you ever seen, I think Michael Knowles is a great example of this. If you ever watch him in interviews, he was on the Jubilee surrounded by liberals, I think. He is one of those guys I think you cannot really rattle. You can't really get a rise out of him. And he just seems very good natured. And then I think it's hard not to like him, even if you didn't agree. And I imagine someone who's able to keep it lighter to, if someone throws out, you know, climate change is real and we're all going to die in 10 years. And you're kind of like lighthearted, like, oh, but they were saying that 10 years ago too. So yeah. I just have a hard time trusting some of this extremism stuff. But hey, I think there's places we need to improve in it. And just this kind of like keeping it a little lighthearted, you can acknowledge, but poke a little fun at things, poke fun at yourself, poke fun at the ideas. Yeah, dude, there are crazy people that are saying they're on my side. I would also like them not to be on my side. That kind of thing, like you're saying, I think it just builds people around you up. You're kind of winning people over because of the way you're going about it, even when people don't agree on anything. And I agree. The finding common ground thing is pretty huge. And maybe being able to like, hey, let's talk about that a little bit more later, but let's transition to, I want to eat turkey right now. And more so, there's some people don't enjoy political conversations. I think you and I probably particularly do. It's part of our work. But a lot of people really get drugged down by it and don't enjoy it. So know how to like shift to other places in a conversation too. Hey, so-and-so was in a play in middle school. Let's hear about that for the next 30 minutes or whatever, you know.
Yeah, good advice. Keep the peace. But if they want to go to war, battle well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Following along in the holiday theme, and you've shared a little bit, you know, as a pastor's wife, pastor's family, you guys went through seasons of you had more money, less money, resources, big, you had four kids, so you had a lot of hungry mouths to feed. I'm curious what advice you would have to folks who face the holiday season, but they really feel the weight of maybe it's financial troubles, stresses at work. We just got laid off. We're about to get laid off, or family, a lot of family drama and troubles. I don't know how this holiday season is going to go if we're even going to so-and-so's house, but especially from a Christian perspective, how did you keep the joy of celebrating the holidays or figure things out even through hard times, especially financial, family? And what would be your encouragement to folks as we face the holidays? Maybe everything is not, doesn't feel settled and easy to do right now.
I think that you as the parent have a lot of power to set the stage for your kids, and you should wield that power very, very well. That there are certainly times where things are lean and things are tense and maybe things are high stakes relationally or financially or whatever. And we went through some of that. Definitely the lean years. I will tell you, I am a master gleaner. I am the queen of finding great food that is just about to go bad and getting it at half price. And I still have those thrifty ways in me that I just like were hammered in when we were on WIC or, you know, living on a pastor's salary and one income in one of the most expensive cities in the country. And so you do get to be very creative about how you put on a great meal. Like I know how to get the free turkey. I can get that free turkey. I know exactly what I need to do and save up and what bulk items to get that I've waited to get the, buy at the one store so I can get the free turkey. Like sometimes it takes some creativity, but you as the parent, people said this to me all the time when my kids were little and I'm like, whatever. They're like, you just need to have your kids have great memories. They just need great memories. Just like help them look back in their childhood and say, oh, that was so sweet and fun. And I'm like, yeah, but you know, like I also have to like pay the bills and I also have to deal with, you know, whatever family member is frustrated with me and said they're not going to come to Thanksgiving this year. And I have to explain to the kid why the uncle or whoever else has decided that they're not going to come this year. Like you as the adult have so much power. And a lot of that power means absorbing the challenges, kind of digesting it so that if it's the kids are exposed to it, they're exposed to it at the level that it's not going to disrupt them. You are there to sort of bear a lot of the burden and a lot of the struggles on behalf of your kids. And I will say that now that my kids are teenagers and young adults, it's interesting because we will have some of their friends over for holidays or on school breaks or things like that. And a lot of times they'll say, hey, I can't wait for this friend to come and sit with us because our family all sits down and has dinner together. Or, oh my gosh, I'm so glad they got to sleep over because they didn't have a mom that made them a big breakfast in the morning. It was always just like whatever you can find in the cupboard. And so I think about that and I think, oh my gosh, we did it. Like we did give our kids kind of the memories. We gave them the sweetness. They're not going to remember whether or not we had this overflowing Thanksgiving table, which sometimes we did and sometimes we didn't. But they are going to look back and remember this sweetness. And it's going to be something that they cherish, even though there were times of serious leanness and even tension during some of those family holidays. Like we were able to absorb it so that our kids didn't have to. And now all that's left for them is these sweet memories.
Yeah. I think it's so important too. I remember my mom, after my parents got divorced, she, I think for that Thanksgiving, we didn't have, her mom had just died, got divorced that first year, but she went and served food at a food bank. And so I think sometimes depending on if it's financial or not, but maybe it's the family disruption to turn and serve, to take your kids and all go deliver presents to someone else, I think can be really huge. And just helping, keeping a Thanksgiving or a giving mindset, even in the midst of things that are quite difficult, really can set a stage to help your kids see it's deeper than just the circumstances that we feel in a moment.
Yeah, that's great advice. Well, we at Them Before Us are so grateful that you chose to join us, that you give us some of your time every weekend, and that you're turning your attention to these matters that are ultimate matters when you're talking about the destiny of children. And we need an army of adults to defend them, especially Christians. That's our job. And everybody at Them Before Us thanks you and wishes you a wonderful, joyous, faith-filled, laughter-rich holiday. We'll see you next week.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.